Good afternoon. Welcome to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio, Inc., a League of Nations, among other internet radio talk station, Voices of the People, United We Roar. Today is January 11th, 2008, and today also is Happiness for Women Only with co-host Martha Trowbridge. Good afternoon, Martha.
Well, good afternoon, Lillian. How are you?
I am fine, thanks.
That's great. I'm Martha Trowbridge. This is Happiness for Women Only, and our guest is Elise D. Cherry. She is Chief Executive Officer of Boston Community Capital and President of Boston Community Venture Fund, a BCC affiliate, which invests in businesses that have the potential to, it's awfully dark today, I'm sorry, which have the potential to achieve social and financial returns. Under her leadership, Boston Community Capital has invested more than $350 million in low-income communities. A former partner at the prestigious Boston law firm Hale & Dorr, Elise began her career as a Vista volunteer. She is vice chair of the board of Opportunity Finance Network, chair of the board of the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and past chair of the board of directors of Mass Equality. She's a graduate of Wellesley College and Northeastern University School of Law. On a personal note, many moons ago when we were turning 10, Elise and her family moved into the beach house across the street on Boston's North Shore. Immediately, I was drawn to her keen intellect, huge grin, and impish spirit. We became fast friends, and though we were only a month apart in age, Elise was legions ahead of me in her grasp of the world and what it takes to be effective. Oh, so generous even then, she taught me the value of earning money, facilitating my employment, delivering morning newspapers, and later as a sales girl on an ice cream vending truck. Evenings, while mosquitoes swarmed above the sand, she taught me how to fish. So many things Elise taught me, but most importantly, she taught me that a girl could be strong and effective and independent. What Elise continues to this day to teach me is how vast a woman's potential is, and how accessible that potential is with focus, discipline, and purity of purpose. Elise, welcome to Happiness for Women Only.
Well, heavens, thanks very much for that extraordinary introduction.
Bringing up some memories, huh?
Certainly does.
Well, today we're going to explore power, in particular women in power. And Elise, you and I have had several conversations about the work of Dr. Jean Baker Miller.
Sure.
And so today we're going to take a look at her book, Toward a New Psychology of Women. And maybe we could start by defining power. As you know, Dr. Miller defines power as the capacity to implement. Dr. Jay Greenberg, I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, but in a landmark book, Oedipus and Beyond, goes further and says effectance is one of the two core drives in humans, the other being safety. How do you define power, Elise?
Well, Martha, you know, it's a very interesting question, particularly as we watch the national Democratic primaries play out. The issue of women in power is very much on everybody's screen at the moment. From my perspective, you know, I think of power as the ability to help to create the kind of world that each of us wants, right? That there's an ability to move an agenda forward, to achieve a goal. And I think that there's so much confusion about this term. Is it really power to control other people? Is it power to effect an end? Is it power for its own sake? Is it power in the service of something greater? And we use the same word to describe all of it. But my own sense, as I say, is there is a world that I would like to see in which that has greater equality, that is more receptive to progressive values, and I think that the sense of power is really toward that world, to creating the world we want. And I guess the other thing that I would say about it, I often think about this not so much in terms of the word power as much as I do in terms of the sense of both responsibility and authority. Women often take on great responsibility, but sometimes that responsibility doesn't come with sufficient authority to actually execute. And so I think that when I think about power, it really is some balance between responsibility and authority. And I guess the final thing I would just say in opening is the question of using power, of executing, of pursuing an agenda, I think really has to be backstopped by an internal sense of values and ethics. It's not enough to simply want to get somewhere. I think that you really have to understand where it is you're trying to go and why it is that you want to be there and how that fits into your internal sense of values. I suppose I think of it as something of an internal lodestone that really helps direct the way each of us goes.
Mm. Well, that calls to mind a wonderful quote on page 116 of Dr. Miller's book, Toward a New Psychology of Women, where she says, quote, power has generally meant the ability to advance oneself and simultaneously to control, limit, and, if possible, destroy the power of others, which is a gross misuse of power. I'm sure you would agree with that.
I would totally agree with that.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe we could move on and talk about your experiences with power, Elise, from early on, from when you were a girl forward, and if you don't mind sharing with us a little bit about your early history when you were, well, you and I met at age 9 going on 10. If you want to talk about some of your experiences then through middle school and high school and then on to college, that would be great.
Geez. Again, I think that, you know, it's been a pretty consistent, I don't know whether a 10-year-old can be described as having a worldview, but to the extent that one can, I guess mine has been a pretty consistent worldview. And so in those days, you know, I think one of the great challenges for girls is has nothing to do with thinking about executing, you know, about exercising power over someone else. It really is about trying to gather up enough force internally to be able to move in the world. And in those days, what that really did mean was figuring out some source of income that was appropriate for tweens or low or young teenagers. And we did indeed deliver newspapers. In fact, I recall it was the first time in the history of Revere that girls had been allowed to deliver newspapers. Why exactly that was a gender-limited occupation, I'm not sure.
How did you persuade the manager to allow you to take the route? I know you had a route before I did.
I think I just finally argued him into it. I mean, he said, oh, no, only boys do this, and I couldn't figure out why. I kept asking. The truth was he couldn't figure out why either.
It
just had always been that way. And, you know, he needed somebody to deliver,
and
I was it. So once it happened, you know, he was willing to give it a try, and then it was really about executing. And of course, it was a wonderful thing because in those days, it was a way to make enough money as a youngster to really, you know, it really did mean that you could exercise some control over your life in a different way. You could buy things, you could get onto the buses, you could find books, all kinds of things.
So your experience from the time from girlhood on was that power was a positive thing. It was not something to be afraid of or to be uncomfortable with. Is that correct?
I think that's right. And that went, I suppose, really right along into high school. We ran a high school newspaper. I remember I was a co-editor-in-chief with another old friend.
It was
about trying to create an environment within the high school and then the school system that promoted good, solid education and equality and ability to participate in civic affairs. In fact, I remember somewhere in there writing a draft constitution for the high school. And again, the idea was the same, that what we were trying to do was to assure a very broad-based participation in student affairs.
So as you got older, did you encounter greater obstacles to the exercise of your power, say, when you were in college or afterwards?
Well, I'm not certain I ever paid a whole lot of attention to the obstacles, which I suppose maybe part of how you move forward. But I will also say I went to Wellesley College as an undergraduate, and Wellesley College does not create obstacles for women in power.
In fact, the
whole premise of the institution is really to create a place where women can come into their own. And so it was a wonderful experience for me. And then subsequent, you know, I'm sure there were lots and lots of times that gender issues emerge, but I think my habit was to ignore them as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. So now we are moving forward to when you, after law school, you went to work for, you started as a VISTA volunteer.
That's right.
And then went to work at a law firm in Boston, is that correct?
No, actually, I did a stint at the National Labor Relations Board in between, pursuing labor relations, violations of the National Labor Relations Act and representation elections for union representation.
And what was the response? Now we're talking, is this still the 70s, the late 70s? Or
yeah, I guess
80s?
I joined the NLRB in 1977.
Right, so what was the reaction by then? At that time, wasn't the legal world still largely populated by men?
Well, it certainly was, and you know, it's funny, this is not something I've thought about in years, but one of the things I recall from that period at the National Labor Relations Board was we covered New England in those days, and there was interesting work to be done in the very most north country of Maine, way, way up in the forestry workers were organizing up there. And traditionally, it had been a place that they sent men. And nobody really thought about it, you know, because after all, it was out in the woods and all of the forestry guys were men, and so you just sent a man. But I, of course, thought it would be a really interesting place to go you know, kind of made a bit of a fuss about it, and it was the same thing. It was like, oh, yeah. And I wound up being able to go up above Presque Isle and drive into the woods and really had...
And you were alone?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, you'd be with a union rep or whatever, but often not. No, you just went up alone.
Wow.
And that was a wonderful set of experiences. And then coming into my law firm, well, it was interesting. By the time I joined the firm, that would have been 1984, women were beginning to come into the profession in larger numbers, but the number of women who actually wound up as partners was a very small number. And so and we all knew it, and so there was a great deal of organization among the women in the firm and also with men in the firm who generally shared a more feminist perspective. And well, my very first partners meeting, actually, that I ever attended as a very young partner, I worked with... I guess the folks in what we would now call IT and also in the human resources area to put together a chart. And you have to understand, this was in the days before you could just whip these things out in a computer. So
right.
Put together a chart showing that the number of women who became partner was, as a percentage matter, was tiny compared to the number of men who came in and became partner. And I, you know, it seems a little ludicrous in retrospect, but I was just... you know, I really sort of thought if they had that information, then it would change people's view. In fact, what happened is it created quite an uproar.
I'm sure at an old Yankee firm like Hale & Dorr, well, a woman challenging. Oh, my gosh.
The firm had a wonderful firm, and it actually had a wonderful history of representing indigent clients and homeless people and a whole bunch of stuff.
Right.
But I think perhaps they had not quite been challenged in this way, and we were off at a partner's retreat off-site, I guess on the Cape, and as I later heard, one of my more senior partners was running around yelling that I should be fired because created Exhibit A to a sex discrimination complaint, and which really had not been my intent.
So
what happened is a number of folks managed to calm him down and point out that, in fact, the firm was better off knowing those figures than not. And
mm-hmm.
You know, and so it went on from there. But that has continued to be a real issue in the legal industry. I mean, certainly things are much better now than they were in the early 80s. But it's been a challenge for women nonetheless to continue forward and really to achieve partnership and to really be able to engage in rainmaking in the same way as many of their male colleagues.
Right. Well, what advice would you give for women who wish to develop their power more? We might think of it expressing in four domains: in the arena of the domain of self-power, relational power, professional power, and political power. What do you see? What advice could you offer women who want to improve their situations in each of those four domains, beginning with self-power?
Well, I do think that personal power, that internal sense of authority and power, is probably the key to any other kind of power. In some ways, it really is a matter of you just got to get out there and do it, you know. And I think often we often ensure the very result we most fear, and so you know, people, women who are afraid of being perceived as too powerful or whatever, you can back up so much that instead what you wind up with is a real sense of powerlessness. But I think that you just have to put one foot in front of the other in many ways and move forward and continue to act. I think it's extremely important to ally with others around you, which is really the relational power issue that I think you're describing. And I think it's important to take on responsibility and then to insist really that you have authority that is consistent with that responsibility. Because I think that one of the things, and we've seen this many, many times, is that women will wind up doing lots and lots of the work and a male colleague sort of waltzes in and takes credit for it. And I think that assuring that authority goes with the responsibility is an important piece of that. And so that certainly is a piece of advice that I would give to any young woman starting out. The other thing I think is I feel very blessed over the years to have had a whole series of women mentors. And I would really encourage young women to pursue mentorship possibilities as well. And I would also say that it's important to understand that mentoring is really a two-way street. It's not just about older and more experienced women, you know, offering their wisdom or guidance or leadership, but it really is also about the younger woman doing everything that she can to learn those lessons, to be helpful, to come along, and so that a real partnership develops. And I think, as I say, in my younger years, I was very much blessed to have other women who chose to mentor me. As I've gotten more mature in my own professional and personal life, I've now taken that on as a responsibility that I feel very strongly about.
Yes, and you and I would both encourage older women to take the energy to invest in younger women.
It's absolutely.
It makes such a difference.
Absolutely, it does.
So political power, I know this is one of your great interests. What do you have to say about that?
Well, again, you know, I think that it often helps to understand the system in which you're trying to function, but once you do understand it, I think that the political world really is a place where stepping up and offering and then actually getting something done helps you move forward pretty quickly. And, you know, in terms of working in political campaigns, for the most part, I mean, there are obviously an industry of people who are paid for that, but volunteers are an incredibly important piece of those campaigns. And so the willingness to either organize people or hold fundraisers or make telephone calls or work on policy papers or whatever, I think moves you up pretty quickly in terms of the way people think about you when they're really trying to figure out how to get work done. And again, this is the whole issue of authority and responsibility. You don't just want to be in there as a drone working away, but you really want to be certain that people understand the contribution you're making. In terms of actually running for political office, I have to say, it is extremely interesting to me, and I've been paying very close attention to the primary season here and, of course, the months leading up to it. But the level of discomfort that people seem to have with the idea of a woman running for president is, to my mind, just extraordinary. And I think, in addition to thinking that Hillary will make a great president, one of the reasons I'm delighted that she's running is because I think by airing a number of those issues, people begin to get them into the front part of their minds where they can kind of take them apart and analyze them and look at them and maybe reach a more sensible conclusion. You know, there are a number of countries in the world that at this stage have or have had women as their chief leader, either prime minister or president, and it's high time. And I think that we really as a nation need to examine some of our prejudices around this so that we can understand and make a more informed decision. You know, it's extraordinary. I think even Hillary Clinton's adversaries would agree that she has the most experience, and yet, you know, it really is an uphill battle for her. I think it's interesting. We've all become much more used to having people in the workplace, women and men in the workplace, and in campaigns and in philanthropic undertakings and so forth. And even in the Congress, we're doing better. But it is clear that when it really comes to that top job, there are a whole lot of folks who kind of take a deep breath.
Well, you're chair of the board of several organizations.
Yes.
Have you ever noticed men feeling uncomfortable with your being in that leadership position?
I suppose I'd be lying if I said no to that one.
So
yeah.
Have noticed that, and of course we will not name groups or names, but how do you make an effort to sort of quiet their fears or discomfort, or how do you handle that?
Oh, it depends. Sometimes I'm just annoyed with them.
Understandably so.
I confess that patience is not necessarily a virtue I always possess. But, you know, my sense of it is that you try and build as broad an alliance as you can, but recognize along the way that there are some folks you're going to be more allied with than others.
Yes.
And I think that among the things that you can do, and particularly if you've got a fairly decent set of alliances going, is you don't have to take on every obligation yourself. You can actually get other folks to give you a hand with people who are perhaps less comfortable. Now, it isn't always successful, but I think it's important to recognize that really everything we do as part of a team, whether we describe it that way or not. Very few of us are sole actors in the world. And it can sometimes be easier for people to hear one or another thing from one or another member of the team. And so that's one strategy to pursue. A second strategy is to have direct conversations with people. And a third strategy is really to just put up with the fact that people are uncomfortable and aren't necessarily going to change.
What do you think accounts for that discomfort?
What do I think accounts for the
discomfort? For the discomfort of a man feeling, oh, my gosh, she's in charge. That's a huge question.
I think others far more qualified than I have really written and discussed that at great length. But, from a feminist perspective, and certainly I would describe myself as a feminist, you know, when you look at how power has historically been allocated in the United States, women have always struggled with that. So I think that I think boys get raised that way. I think girls get raised that way, frankly, to have an expectation that men are more often in positions of power than not. I think that's changing. I think the current generation of parents and the current generation of teachers are doing a lot to move kids to a much more equal view of the world. But I think it's a very long-standing problem. And I think, there are some folks who say that so long as women sleep with their oppressors, nothing much is going to change. I don't know, but I do think that there are all of the interrelated emotional issues that come from joining intimately with men or raising boy children or, you know, all, and women tend to be supportive in those roles often, and I think everybody kind of gets used to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to future needed power initiatives for women. Since the publication of Dr. Miller's book in 1976, we've seen tremendous advances in women's power.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as necessary power initiatives for women in the future?
Well, among the things I worry about is elder poverty when it comes to women, because the gender gap is still very much present with respect to income, and because women live longer, we tend to have many more impoverished women at the end of their lives than men. And I think that our pension systems, our Social Security systems, and our income systems really need to be adjusted in order to account for that. Evelyn Murphy wrote a wonderful book called Getting Even, I think, which was really explored the entire issue of comparable worth and equal pay. And I do think that is a critical thing. I also, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of the White House Project, but that's been a very interesting piece of political work in terms of really trying to move women up the political chain, and I think that will be extremely useful. I think, also having women take on a larger role in terms of CEO roles, both in large companies and small, creates the set of kind of role models that I think are terrific for young girls coming through. And I think the more familiar and the more ordinary it seems to be for women to fill roles of power, then the easier it is to move along in that way. And we have made a lot of progress. It's just that we haven't made enough progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to our discussion? I know we've covered quite a few topics quickly, and just wondering if you have anything else you'd like to say to our listeners.
No, except to say that I appreciate very much the opportunity to discuss this issue, and I'm delighted to know that you are doing radio shows that really are focused in this way. We are a long way from our early girlhood, but in some ways, not so far at all.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you. Well, Elise, rather than seek fame and fortune, you've chosen to invest your innumerable and great talents in efforts that affect the betterment of humankind, and you're such an inspiration to us all. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you.
If you would like to write to Elise, you may reach her via email at echerry, and that's C-H-E-R-R-Y, at bostoncommunitycapital.org. Thanks to Barbara Becker-Holstein for creating Happiness for Women Only. Thanks to Lillian Caldwell, our producer and owner of Passionate Internet Voices Radio. Till next time, dear listeners, I am Martha Trowbridge.
Thank you very much for listening to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio. You have just listened to Martha Trowbridge and Happiness for Women Only. And if you want to hear this interview all over again, please go over to http://internetvoicesradio.com. On the left-hand side of the page, you will see the word archives. Click on it. A list of names will appear. Dr. Holstein's name, click on Dr. Holstein's name, and then you'll see the program Happiness for Women Only, hosted by Martha Trowbridge, and you can listen to the program. If you want a hard copy of today's program, go back to http://internetvoicesradio.com, click on the word live, and scroll down the page until you come to Deb Harris's name and email. Copy and paste it. Put today's date, 1/11/08, the time, 2 to 2:30, and Martha Trowbridge's name, and Deb Harris will take excellent care of you. PIVTR, whether providing you with the advice of experts or giving a voice to the average person who would not otherwise be heard. PIVTR emphasizes quality and enriching programs for our listeners' enjoyment. And G.K. Chesterton had this to say, literature is a luxury. Fiction is a necessity. Thank you very much for listening. Our next program scheduled is The Proper Care and Feeding of Your Soul with Deborah Lentz Hill and David Lentz, and then What a Woman Can Do with Holly Campbell. So please stay tuned. Thank you very much for listening, and remember, keep listening.